ring the bells and we raise the strain. We hang the garlands everywhere and bid the tapers twinkle fair, and then back to the same old lives again. Dr. James S. Stewart, the famous Scottish preacher, writes, "It's not the easiest thing in the world getting back to normal when Christmas has come and gone for another year. Like all experiences that lift us for a moment out of the groove of the common days, Christmastide can be unsettling." Do you find it so? I had set aside Tuesday, December the 11th, to drive down to the cottage in the country and to sit in my little writing shed and to write the sermon for Christmas Day. What a disaster. I didn't get down there until it was dark. It's dark anyway at the end of the road, and I was all alone. Thank goodness my neighbor had walked over and put a bit of heat on so it wasn't exactly icy cold. I looked in the larder just to see if any little mice had been visiting, and the first thing I encountered was death in large numbers. Three mice on a sticky pad who'd been there how long? Welcome to the country. And the next day I went out to my little shed and opened it. It was just like an ice box, so I plugged in the little heater and immediately blew the fuse and was sitting there in the dark with my pen and my coat and my gloves. I went back into the house and down through the crawl space into the basement to the switch box, and I couldn't for the life of me find the switch that operated the outside building, so I couldn't turn the heat back on. So I sat at another table in a place I wasn't planning, and I wrote the sermon, and I read it back, and it was unpreachable. Other than that, I was having a very good time, and it was only Monday morning at noon. So I tried again. I was thinking that the lectionary texts used for Christmas Day are not really about Christmas. Indeed, most of the Old Testament texts that are used to carry the story of Christ were not written directly to do with Jesus. They were written about something far older and far deeper than that, of which Jesus is a symbol. They were written about a hope of that one who is to come, the one who is to be born in our own flesh, who will finally show us with clarity the great God whom we sense in our highest and best moments. So the texts chosen for a Christmas day are about other things, and they've been stretched like colorful socks over the feet of Christmas to keep it warm. Isaiah chapter 52, from which John Joseph read, by the way, this morning, was written very much after the fact. It's a poem, and it recalls the sudden release of Jewish exiles who had been held prisoner in the Babylonian Empire for 50 years. Well, not prisoners exactly. They were welcome to live in their own part of the empire and to follow their own customs. But after a while, the empire became seductive, as empires do, and the people began to like it there. And they began to do all the imperial things and not do the little special Jewish things that used to sustain them. And then, all of a sudden, Cyrus, the upstart ruler from the small kingdom next door, started a war against the Babylonian Empire, and the empire was so corrupt that Babylon fell without a shot being fired. And suddenly Cyrus, this jumped-up nobody, was the new emperor of the Persian Empire, and his policy changed. In the Babylonian Empire, when a people was conquered, the whole people was taken from their home territory and set down in foreign territory on the other side. You don't have any trouble with people on the other side still being strangers. But when Cyrus came, he said, "All right, all you displaced people over the last 50 or 60 years, you can all go home now. Where you go, go home." And so we see migrants and refugees on the move across the Holy Land. Ever seen that before? Now, this release of the Jews was no picnic, because home, as they had known it, was long gone. They had no right to possess their houses anymore. Other people had been living in them for 50 years, because just as they had been removed, Babylon had brought people from other places and stuck them in the Holy Land, and so people were living in the houses that used to belong to the Jews. Old walls had been knocked down, old customs were no longer practiced, and so this second and third generation of Judaism was a stranger in its own land. They experienced poverty and restlessness and resentment. People around them didn't like them being back, felt the threat of strangers who could take possession of their homes. But the poet, you see, Isaiah, writing in retrospect many years later, began to see a mighty hand in all this. Something else was happening in all this. He began to suggest to this needful people that something unexpected had moved heaven and earth to bring these people home. The next generation of returnees, who were still in a fog about their new estate, began to read Isaiah's poetry, and they began to see different underplanking. They began to see girders being erected that were bringing a faith to them with a strength they'd never experienced before. They were not forgotten, after all. There was hope for them in the ruins, they began to say. Divine providence was on the playing field again. Now, to be honest, in history, this hopeful moment was but a blip, because it became the stuff of saga and legend and tribal song. And there's nothing wrong with that. These things are really important to us, to sing our tribal songs and to believe in the mythos and the legends that surround us. They come from a very, very deep place. And it's amazing how you realize it without recognizing that you do. At first, I went to a Christmas lunch not so long ago, and they had a silent auction there, and I didn't know much about silent auctions, and I wasn't bidding on the hockey shirts and so on, but I walked over to the second table, and there were paintings there, prints of paintings by Norvel Morisseau, the First Nations artist, and they were just sitting on the floor and no one was looking at them, and I think I bid $100 for two of them, and I walked away, and by the end of the event I was the only one who bid on the things, and so I brought home two great prints of Norvel Morisseau, whose style I really like, but I thought, what in the world am I going to do with these prints of Morisseau? And then I looked at the titles of them. I'd never even looked at the titles of them before. One of them was called The Meeting of the Shaman. And you see the two spiritual leaders standing with 1,000 ideas and symbols coming out of their heads and filling the air. That's my kind of mythos. And the other was called Between the Worlds. And there were people gathering and lifting up their children, and above them stood the great Thunderbird. And the wings of the Thunderbird covered them and sheltered them. That's my mythos. That's my world. And suddenly I realized, in the flow of history that goes on in newspaper headlines and the nightly news, there is something else at work, poetry and saga and meaning. And now those two paintings grace the wall of the room in which I sit every day. And yet it was a passing blip historically. Here on the ground, new empires rolled across to take over those budding dreams. Alexander the Great came along, conquered them all, brought Greek culture to them all, and then he died suddenly in his 30s, and his generals stepped in to fill the vacuum, and the Ptolemies began to reign there, and Antiochus Epiphanes and the others began to reign there and to show oppression there, and then the Romans came and finished them off, and then there was a war, and then the Jews were scattered, never fully to return again. Still, it is a good thing, I feel, to remember that the cosmos remembers us. These are still mountaintop moments of connection, and they go deep in us, and we chew on them, and we find nourishment in them, and they anchor us more deeply for the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Well, the second text that doesn't really fit into Christmas is from the letter of the writer to the Hebrews, and it is said to be especially beautiful. The New Testament Greek says that this first verse, which was read today, is the most perfect New Testament Greek in the whole of the New Testament. That verse in Greek, one sentence, gorgeous all the way through. Now, my New Testament Greek isn't the best, but I believe the commentators. As a matter of fact, my New Testament Greek isn't much at all. I took 1 year of New Testament Greek, and our professor at the end of the first term was on St. John chapter 1, verse 1. Spent the whole 3 months on verse 1. Well, I lost him at the first word. And at the end of every lesson, he'd stop the class and he'd say, "Mr. Sinclair, I can't do it for you." And I said to him, "Sir, I can't do it for myself." Nonetheless, the Greek struggled on, and I do have a book upstairs in which I can cross-reference words, and I do. But this piece of Greek, it is said, was the finest Greek in the New Testament. The writer in it then goes on to model the biblical characters and their faith. That's what the letter's about. He said, Moses believed this, and so do we, and Abraham believed this, and so do we. And we are to trust the eternal God and to have faith. And the author goes on to say, though we die, we shall embrace another country. And our true nature and our full destiny are beyond earthly circumstances and beyond mortal limits. My Greek may be poor, but my faith in that is strong, and I believe it to be true. He then goes on to write, especially for his Jewish Christian audience, and he talks about the temple blood sacrificial system. Now, this is hard going. It doesn't have much to do with Christmas. It has more to do with Easter when you get that far, but not of Christmas. Because historically, sacrificial blood was shed every day in the temple of Jerusalem. Hundreds of sacrifices, animals slaughtered, and their blood poured against the horns of the altar every day. Blood was the life, and in order to meet the God, you sacrificed your life, symbolized in the animal, to bring reconciliation with the great God in the center of life. It was understood. But it's different for us. The belief was then that the gifts are accepted when we offer them and we become one with the God and our lives are changed. It was happening that way in ancient cultures all over the world. And there's no real comparable model for this in our cultural life. I was thinking about it. It might be slightly seen in the idea of homecoming. You messed up your life. You've alienated yourself from your family. But on Christmas Day, everyone takes a risk, and there's a knock on the door, and suddenly the door is opened, and you are there. And instead of frowns and distance, there is a set of warm arms and lips kissing your cheeks and tears in a mother's eye, and suddenly you are home again, and all is forgiven, and it's a brand new day. Something like that in temple sacrifice. Or refugees who are welcome from the far side of the world, having seen what they've seen. And they are now surrounded with people who care about them. And though they cannot speak their language, they speak with a language that is deeper than words, and it happens. Or soldiers, or other children who have suffered from PTSD and find their arms wrapped around a service dog, and suddenly all is well again, and they feel safe and secure. These are shadow symbols of that great temple sacrifice in Jerusalem, of which the author speaks. And it's wonderful to have such a portrait of our true state above all our wars and our wants. This highly high priestly figure carries our souls in his arms as he goes before the great God and prays on our behalf. And that great high priest, say the early texts, are the child born at Christmas when he grew up. Through the perfect picture of Christ our Lord, we are redeemed forever, says the faith. That's the experienced truth, the evocative imagery of the texts. But it's not the day of delight. The sermon title is the day of delight. The Old Testament allusions are storehouses out of which we gain costumes to wrap around Christmas Day. They are costumes, but they are not the day of delight. And then there's the prologue of John's Gospel. It is a masterpiece of theological thought. John is portrayed in the Book of Kells as an eagle symbol, because it is said that eagles are the only bird that can look directly into the light of the sun. and that John's writing is the purest, that it is looking straight into the Son of God's heart, and John sees it most clearly. So he is the eagle. And in his prologue, John sets forth the idea that John the Baptist is really a forerunner. In the ancient world in Jesus' time, John the Baptist was the true star, and Jesus was playing catch-up. But by the time the church gained strength and began to grow, people said, what about John the Baptist? And so the writer of John's gospel said, let's put him in his place. He is the forerunner. Jesus is the star. He sets John aside in his prologue. And then he goes on to warn us about the reception of the news we carry if we become people of faith. Even his own people did not accept him. So watch yourself out there in the world, he writes. And then he calls us to plumb the depths for our truth. Those who believe in him will be born anew, he writes. They will be given power to become the children of God. Not by human will, not of the flesh, but by the will of God himself. I bask in this. I stand warmed and thrilled in the light of John's gospel. It has always been more dazzling than my mere mind can contain, but I know that the light belongs to me. I am a child of God, and I see how life works through my faith in Jesus Christ. It's true. It's true. Somebody long ago told me the story of Jesus, and I believed it. Someone yesterday told me the story of Jesus, and I believe it. And my heart catches fire all over again. I feel myself walking on a road to eternal life, holding the hand of the Jesus I met so long ago. That, too, is mythos, but it is real, and it fires my soul on a Christmas morning. This is assurance. This is a true experience of joy, but it is not the day of delight. Here is that day of delight thing again. The day of delight on a Christmas day comes from what we do with it. What we do with Christmas Day gives us the day of delight. Whether in action or in memory, the day of delight rises in what we do with it. With smiles or tears, with enthusiasm or reluctance, we live in a cacophony of Christmas today, and what we do with it offers us the day of delight. Be it early mornings with children, chasing elves and reindeer, cleaning up spilled milk and cookie crumbs on the table, whatever it may be, meeting the relatives and hope you don't talk about Donald Trump, whatever it may be, this is the offering of the day of delight. Music, food, drink, laughter, new visitors, old ghosts, it's all here, and it all belongs to us today. Christmas Day is a day of delight, because all across the world, be it Christian or not, people are making something of the phenomenon of Christmas. People are leaning into it in some way. New life is opening new eyes to a waiting world today, in the day of delight. We saw it just the other day down in the out-of-the-cold luncheon. One of the servers gathered among the 200 people who were there for Christmas lunch, and she said to me, I just heard the most wonderful story. Do you want to hear it? It's a Christmas story. Of course I do. Well, there was a woman came in for lunch, came in off the street. She was an older woman, Chinese, and spoke no English. She sat at the table for a while, and after she had eaten, she began to indicate that she wanted to sing something, but no one knew what she wanted to sing. So she wrote it on her napkin in Chinese, and nobody could read it. But then they went around the room, and they found another Chinese person who had enough English to read it, and it said, "The Red River Valley." The woman wanted to sing "The Red River Valley." "I can't play it," said the pianist. And someone at another table said, "Well, I can play it." And the other guest went to the piano and played "Red River Valley," and the Chinese woman got up and sang "Red River Valley" in Chinese. And her face shone like a new dime. And the watchers and the servers said one to the other, "Christ is among us. We have a day of delight on our hands." So here's the news on the day of delight. We're not lost in death. We know moments of rescue from all our wars. A person of great stature and pure heart has entered the Holy of Holies and made peace for us with the great God. We are safe and loved forever. That's the hidden gift in that big box with the red ribbon delivered today. Now, there's always an awkward moment at our family Christmas table, and I'll be walking into it soon. Be driving from here uptown, gathering up the bits and pieces that are left at home, walking into the smell of the bird cooking and vegetables bubbling on the stove, and the family will all be there, and after hors d'oeuvres and a million other things to eat, as if you need them, we'll gather at the dinner at about 6 o'clock, and there'll be silence, and my wife will say, "Be quiet, everyone, Grandpa needs to say something." What do you say? My family is not particularly religious. My children have wonderful values, but have never really fully connected them to the stories that I tell or to the great mythos that carries my spirituality. And so you stumble along and you say, "Well, you've only got 30 seconds for this before all hell breaks loose with the crackers. What are you grateful for?" Well, you get a few words from the president. Who do you remember today? Well, get a little bit of that. What do you hope for? Well, kind of silence. Some wag says, "I hope you'll be finished your remarks soon, Grandpa." And yet we're all happy to be there and to belong to each other. And we remember with a tear and with a full heart those who are no longer sitting at the table with us, but whose presence is very much alive. And we're grateful that we live in relative peace and freedom in a country like this, and to possess the elusive butterfly of health even for a brief time. And we realize that we are in the day of delight, and it is being expressed beyond any words of any grandpa. Delight lives with sentimentality. It's a fabric strung across a variety of great stories and myths and feelings. Our Christmas expression of good practices and noble intentions brings out the best in us and in others this season. So lean into your friendships today. Be as glad to see everyone as you can be. When I get to the house, Fred, our grand dog, will be glad to meet me. He always is. He wraps himself in a full circle and stays that way for about 10 minutes until he finally realizes that I'm staying. Be as happy to see your people as Fred is to see me today on Christmas. It's the day of delight. James S. Stewart writes, "These things are true. I know they're true. The very character and honor of Christ is bound up with their being true. And because they are true, glory be to God in the highest."